are listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to KBOO on Sunday, October 24th for KBOO's Afro-Caribbean and Reggae Marathon. Remember when reggaeton or kuduro hit? Still love the rock steady groove? Or need a jolt of zouk? This marathon will wind you up in the urgency and energy of reggae, cumbia, cueto, zouk, Afro-Latin, kuduro, reggaeton, and more in an immersive experience. Hear longtime hosts and new voices serve you a personal cultural perspective, close to the creative cutting edge of emerging new genres. That's KBOO's Afro-Caribbean and Reggae Marathon on Sunday, October 24th from 10 a.m. to midnight here on your community connection, KBOO Portland.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender justice, and more. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, as Senator Bernie Sanders rails against Joe Manchin and the media for harping on the cost of the Build Back Better bill, we'll speak with Washington Post columnist Helene Olin about what's actually in the bill. Then Marxist economist Richard Wolff will offer his analysis of the Great Resignation and Striketober as masses of American workers are resigning or striking. Finally, Natasha Leonard of The Intercept will share the story of how one Florida anarchist was slapped with a far harsher sentence than most January 6th rioters simply for calling for armed self-defense against white supremacists. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Senator Bernie Sanders on Friday published an op-ed in defense of the Build Back Better bill, citing his colleague Joe Manchin by name as one of the main sources of opposition to legislative provisions that are very popular. Sanders' office also released a statement on the same day pointing out that many Americans know about the price of the bill, but not what's in it. The senator called out journalists, saying, quote, "The mainstream media has done an exceptionally poor job in covering what actually is in the legislation." My guest, Helene Olin, a columnist for The Washington Post, remedied this in her latest column published on Monday, and she now joins me. Helene is the author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry, co-author of The Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. Her work has appeared in Slate, The Nation, The New York Times, The Atlantic, and many other publications. And our latest column in the Washington Post is entitled "Debate Over Which Democratic Proposals to Invest in Shortchanges Our Needs." Welcome to the program, Helene.
Thank you for having me on.
So first, let's talk about Sanders' criticisms. Are they valid? It's true that he cites polls saying that many Americans know that the cost of the bill is $3.5 trillion, but are hard-pressed to point out what's in it.
They're certainly valid on the face. It's not as if the information isn't out there. I mean, but the Washington Post, for instance, we're writing about it on a daily basis. But it's harder to access. You, if you turn on the TV or you turn on, you know, radio news for 5 minutes, you're probably going to hear the horse race debate. The it's 3.5 billion. What will Manchin demand be cut? What about cinema? And, you know, should we have this big amount? And very rarely will you hang around long enough to hear what's actually in the bill. And that's becoming a huge issue because what's in the bill is actually quite popular and a lot of people would actually like it quite a bit.
So let's talk about those details. There is a huge amount of sort of ambition in the bill. One of the things, for example, is a child tax credit, which Democrats in a earlier part of the legislative period expanded and also enabled parents of young children to receive refunds monthly. It's already been proven to reduce poverty and child poverty in particular. This bill, I understand, would make it permanent?
Right. And it would in the few months that we've had it, it has seemingly reduced child poverty by 40%, made a huge impact on children and hunger as well. And it really, making it permanent, would benefit about 65 million children. And we don't hear as much about that. What we hear about again and again is the cost of it. And one of my theories for why that's going on is that it's becoming, we're so used to this sort of talk of austerity. We've had this for now for about 40 years, really, since Reagan was elected president. And we just are used to thinking somehow that we're not deserving of this money being spent on us. And I would say the second part of it is I think there's this lack of recognition somehow that a lot of these investments, and I'm thinking, you know, child tax credits, negotiations for prescription drugs, child care supports, universal pre-K, are things that other first world countries take for granted.
So the cost of doing nothing is something that isn't always tackled, but you tackle it in your Washington Post column. Let's talk about that. Has there been a cost-benefit analysis of what would happen if this bill didn't pass?
Well, what we're seeing is as people are putting together, and I wrote about one done by the Center for American Progress Action Fund, of the costs to us of not putting this through. So, for example, one of the things in the proposal, and supposedly Manchin is not thrilled about it, is $400 billion targeted at home health care services for the elderly and disabled via the Medicaid program. Now, that serves a bunch of different purposes. It keeps people out of nursing homes. Second, that amount of money would fix the backlog in the program. How big is the backlog? There's about 800,000 Americans who have been deemed eligible for such services who can't get them. That's roughly a 3-year backlog. Who's then taking care of them? Well, sometimes they end up in nursing homes. Sometimes their children, often a daughter, leaves work to take care of them or cuts back on work to take care of them. That in turn impacts the ability of women to work. And as most people know at this point, we've had, you know, a huge drop off in women working over the course of the entire pandemic.
Right. It's being dubbed the Great Resignation, mm-hmm. although that obscures the fact that there are so many pressures on women about caregiving responsibilities, the lack of flexibility in the workplace, and just generally speaking, the low compensation. There isn't enough, wages aren't high enough, but there's also just not enough paid leave for care, right? And that's another thing that child care and other types of paid leave for caregiving is would be something that would be mandated for some workers in the bill, right?
Right. It would be up to 12 weeks, which is something, again, that other countries take for granted, paid leave. If you have a child, if you have an ill family member, we don't have that here, and it forces people out of the workforce, and it ultimately impoverishes all of us by having people who otherwise could work and would work, you know, for wages, cannot because they don't want to, not because, you know, they have some sort of entitlement mentality, as Joe Manchin likes to put it, but because there's literally not enough them to work. Right? If you have these family responsibilities and you have paid work and you only have one you, something is going to give. And as I've often pointed out, the something that's going to give is often women. There's a sociologist at the University of Indiana who is fond of pointing out that other countries have social safety nets. In the United States, we just assume we have women who will compensate.
So one of the things that you pointed out, Manchin, you know, who likes to refer, like his Republican colleagues, to the social services as entitlements, he wants to put a work requirement in the child tax credit. And he sort of, you know, he's forced to admit that lowering child poverty is a good thing, but he wants to put work requirements on it. This is also sort of a favorite Republican ploy, right? Make it harder and harder for people to access benefits.
Right. And we know from other, other benefits that, you know, these work requirements are simply a lot of bureaucracy for not a lot of gain. Most people actually want to work. And if they're not working, there's usually a really good reason for it. But, you know, it has a second point, too, which is that in the United States, we are chronically suspicious of benefits that aren't given to everybody. You know, when the minute you begin to limit it, oh, okay, we'll only give child care tax credits to people in poverty. We'll make sure that they're working. You are weakening the support for the benefit and ultimately making it more likely that it will be even further cut back or done away with entirely.
Now, I know that most of the issues that you consider in your column focus on some very direct benefits to ordinary Americans, but it's a big bill, right? The Build Back Better bill has, for example, very strong climate provisions that Joe Manchin is also opposing. And Manchin, of course, wasn't happy about his colleague Sanders calling him out on his opposition to the bill in general and some aspects of the bill. But isn't there also a lot of support for climate change mitigation in the public?
There is. And again, this is also, I mean, I hate to just put this in the talk of economic gain, because, of course, this is, you know, an all but existential crisis for us. But the fact is it's not like you're just taking money that you would spend on climate efforts, you know, to increase, you know, solar and wind, make us less dependent on, polluting technologies. It's not like those are like, you know, just money going down the drain. I mean, those are huge investments in the economy, and those will also grow jobs and, you know, grow jobs of the future and grow jobs that, you know, people can have. I mean, we need to invest in our future, and all of this, you know, child care, family leave, you know, climate change, these are all investments in the future that we have simply have not made in adequate form for decades, if ever. And asking people to choose between them, which is essentially what Manchin is doing at this point, is kind of, you know, both, you know, counterproductive and is actually setting people off against each other. It's almost this kind of political Hunger Games where it's like, okay, what's more important, family leave or childcare? Well, the answer is both, right? We need both of those, and we need those desperately. That's what will benefit us personally as a nation, as people, us as a nation, and us economically.
It wasn't just Senator Bernie Sanders who lambasted the media for not emphasizing the content of the bill. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki has done so as well. Do you think that it would be valid for, you know, papers, not just the Washington Post, the New York Times, or even TV outlets like CNN to really focus on here's how, terrible the U.S. is compared to other countries on child care, the cost of child, subsidizing the cost of child care, for example, or the lack of paid care leave, and really focusing on those bread and butter issues, even if they, you know, even if it may not generate as much ad revenue or, you know, be as clickbaity as something more sensational, right? It feels as though these sorts of stories are seen as boring.
I think, you know, it's actually a three-way street in this case, right? Yes, media could stand to emphasize this more, but I also need to point out that people do need to engage with it more. And that brings me to my third point, the third street here, which is it would also truthfully help if the Biden administration emphasized this more.
Right, and he has a bully pulpit, and right. You think he hasn't used it enough?
I don't believe he's used it enough. I mean, he's certainly speaking out now, but he needs to speak out more forcefully. He needs to speak out constantly. And it needs to be Joe Biden, not Jen Psaki. I mean, that's just a, you know, a basic fact. I mean, he's the president. We need to hear it from him, and we need to hear it from him over and over and over again.
Right. And this is something that, unfortunately, many centrist Democrats have been guilty of doing in the past. Often they're ready to fall over and cave to Republican demands. They might sort of, instead of starting at their, you know, best wish list, their starting point is often what they think is practically possible. Then Republicans whittle it down more. We have a new dynamic here this time, and that is that there is a strong House Progressive Caucus. We've talked about the Senate, Senators Manchin and Sanders, but in the House, you have Pramila Jayapal, who has really, it seems, been quite strong about trying to, you know, help Biden, because ultimately it's Biden's agenda that she's pushing, right?
Right. And our thoughts were going in the same exact way. So I was going to answer whatever question you asked me, actually, with this next, right? I think for everyone involved of the traditional gatekeepers, media, Washington insiders, you know, fill in the blank, this is actually a major change. For the past several decades, we've been kind of used to this centrist, you know, conversation where progressives are sort of considered to be out in the wilderness, and, you know, people are appealing to some mythical centrist voter. And by the way, let me be clear, the centrist voter is something of a myth, right? The centrist voter would really like to see pharmaceutical price negotiation and childcare supports, okay? So let me just get that out there. But so the result is we've always had this dynamic where it seems that, well, the progressives need to give and like the centrists are, quote, the reasonable people. And in fact, what's really going on here to a huge extent is in many cases here, the progressives are the reasonable group, and it's the centrists who are both out of touch with the mainstream of the Democratic Party, out of touch with a huge chunk of the American public, and are the ones really saying my way or the highway, not as is usually portrayed, the progressives. The progressives are actually saying, what can we do? How can we make a deal here? How can we get this solved? And we have, you know, the moderate wing really sort of all over the place, not being forthright. You know, Kyrsten Sinema won't even give interviews, won't say publicly what she wants.
I think she's busy doing fundraisers in Europe, I heard.
Right. I mean, and at what point do you say that's not reasonable? We have a crisis. What are you doing in Europe anyway? I mean, Kyrsten Sinema has more free time than I do. I find it astonishing.
Right. She's a senator of the United States.
Right.
And that's another point.
Internship.
You and me both. Does the slow walking of this bill, I mean, this debate has now stretched out, this negotiation over the Build Back Better bill, which is then being, you know, sort of holding up the infrastructure bill. It's been stretching for weeks as if the Senate has nothing better to do. You know, they're busy confirming Rahm Emanuel to an ambassadorship. But does the slow walking of this negotiation in the end benefit the centrists, the Manchins and the Sinemas?
Of course it does. And it benefits for a couple of different reasons. First, everybody sort of throws their hands up and like Washington again, right? Failed us again.
It erodes public trust, it seems.
It erodes public trust. It also makes it, Biden became president in mid-January. You know, you have a certain initial enthusiasm rush. This is a very normal and well-known phenomena. Yes, the quicker things could have gotten through, the more likely they would have been to have gotten through. There has just been a huge amount of, you know, wasted, you know, time at this point where, you know, it just feels like, you know, the country is adrift, as adrift as, you know, a boat, you know, trying to dock at one of the ports and can't get in. You know, it makes people very frustrated. Because again, most people have their lives, they have their families, they have their work, they have their hobbies, they have their life, basically. They're not paying, you know, attention to this 24/7. And it just makes it feel like it's not happening and Washington failed them.
It seems as though there are already some provisions that are on the chopping block that Manchin and Sinema are, particularly Manchin, are demanding. Do you think that senators like him and the cinema are going to face any kind of a downside or a reprimand from voters at the polls, because they seem so self-satisfied and so smug, and so they seem so safe. Because, of course, they're able to fundraise from their corporate donors, which then gives them the money to put forward all sorts of campaign rhetoric that's out of touch with what they're really doing. But I would like to think that voters are smarter.
I mean, it's, they're both up for re-election in a couple of years. So, given a lot can happen between now and then. But I think that, Kyrsten Sinema definitively feels very out of touch with the Democratic primary voters of Arizona at this point. I don't think there's a huge controversy about that. When you're avoiding questions from your own, voters, when you don't do press conferences, you barely speak to reporters, I mean, the chances are incredible you're going to have a problem, even if it's not related to this going forward. Because people don't like that. I mean, they really, really don't. They want to hear from their politicians. I mean, I think the situation with Joe Manchin is slightly different because West Virginia is a very different state than Arizona. For starters, it doesn't have a load of people from California moving in every day. And it's a more conservative place. And I do think that changes the calculation. But I will also say that Joe Manchin actually does engage, right? If you yell at him on his boat, he will talk to you.
Well, let's also finally point out, as you've said earlier, we don't actually know what it is that Manchin and Sinema want. Manchin is a little bit more forthcoming. He wants the work requirements on the child tax credit expansion, making it permanent. He wants to remove some climate provisions. But he doesn't seem to be giving enough of a goalpost, right, for the progressive who are campaigning on behalf of the Biden agenda, and neither does Sinema. They aren't making clear what it is that they will settle to. It seems as though they made these vague pronouncements about wanting the bill to be cheaper.
Right. There's this sort of idea, well, we're negotiating in private, but actually the public deserves to know at this point.
Right. And is it even clear if they're negotiating in private?
No, it's not.
Because the progressive lawmakers don't seem to be knowing about it.
No, and for the record, no, it's not clear. And it does feel sort of performative, but performative for what? I can't say. Because so far it's just sort of led to this, what seems to me anyway, an increased cynicism by the public, an increased throwing up of people's hands, and an increased feeling that, once again, Washington is failing everybody.
Well, Helene, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your article in the Washington Post from our website. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
My guest has been Helene Olin. She is a columnist of the Washington Post, author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. Her column in the Post, published Monday, is entitled Debate Over Which Democratic Proposals to Invest In Shortchanges Our Needs. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupatsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The latest Bureau of Labor Statistics report has shown that a record 2.9% of the American workforce quit their jobs in August. That's equivalent to 4.3 million resignations. Economists are calling this the Great Resignation. At the same time, an estimated 100,000 union workers across the country were either on strike or threatened to strike over contract negotiations this month, leading analysts to dub it Striketober. Joining me to put these trends into context is the great Marxist economist Richard Wolff. Richard Wolff is a professor Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's taught at Yale University and at the City College of the University of New York. He is currently a visiting professor in the Graduate Program in International Affairs of the New School University in New York City and the host of the weekly radio and TV program Economic Update. His books include The Sickness Is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself, as well as Understanding Socialism and Understanding Marxism, which has just been republished with a new introduction. He's a frequent guest on our program. Welcome back, Richard.
Glad to be here, Sonali, and glad as always to speak with you.
So let's talk about this great resignation. It's been months now that a lot of economists have been warning it would come. The August numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics sort of prove that there is indeed a trend of Americans resigning en masse in great numbers, rather. And there have been a lot of polls trying to understand why it is that they're resigning. Some say, you know, show that at least a third of Americans want better compensation. Others just feel like they're not respected at work. So how do you analyze why we're seeing so many people resigning?
Well, I think, first of all, let's be clear that this is historically exceptional. We've kept statistics on what is called the quit rate, the rate at which people quit their jobs because they really can't stand them anymore. And we've kept records of that for a long time. This is, the current readings are off the chart. They are historically extraordinary. And we haven't had a strike wave like this in decades in this country. So yes, something very special is going on. Workers, and this is the key point, are very angry, upset, bitter, and they're quitting their jobs. They're fighting to improve their jobs by striking. They're taking these kinds of actions. And while we can look at this or that particular reason, let us be for a moment a little more historically broad-minded. And here's what I mean. The bottom line here is what we used to call, and we should call again, class struggle. It's employers against employees. Both the employer and the employees were badly shaken in the last 18 months by the combination of an economic crash almost as bad as the Great Depression and the worst public health failure slash disaster this country has ever experienced in its entire history. And we had both of these crises at the same time. It shook everybody. It shook employers because they had to do without profits in many cases for quite a while. And it shook workers who were unable to go to work, who had new responsibilities at home, who had their children to care for. It shook us all. And now that we are maybe, hopefully, coming out of it, the employers decided, well, we're going to do something about the profits we didn't get, the hard time we went through. And what that means to an employer is recoup the profits we didn't get. And so they did. And you know how they're doing it? By having three people do the job they used to hire four for, by decreasing in many ways the benefits of the job, by not raising the wages at all, or in some cases, lowering them. And for the mass of employees, they're discovering not only that their lives were shaken in the last 18 months, but they're returning to a job that is now less advantageous than it was before, at a time when they are wanting more, not less, to compensate them for the last 18 months. And as if to make it finally unbearable, we have the inflation now running at better than 6%, which means that if you're not earning more than 6% today compared to what you would have gotten a year ago if you'd been working then, if you're not 6% ahead, it means you can't afford to buy now what you were able to afford to buy a year ago. The inflation on top of everything else, it's just too much. Too much squeezing of the majority by the employer minority, and it is blowing people's minds and leading to the quitting and the striking.
there were some remarkable videos that young workers have been posting, you know, to their favorite social media platforms, of them taking to their store's PA system and publicly resigning. There's a trending hashtag, quit my job. So it seems as though people are not only fed up with their work situation, but are willing to talk about it. That's a good sign, right? Because being able to talk about it can help generate a national dialogue.
That's exactly what's happening. People are quitting, and then they're going to their friends or having a cup of coffee or a beer and explaining to themselves, of course.
Or posting it to TikTok and getting a million views.
Exactly. And that, now that we have that, it's a conversation that everybody is hearing. And everybody recognizes this sense of having had a very hard 18 months and now going back into a job that is, if anything, less rewarding, less acceptable, less supportive than it was before, and saying, I've had it. You know, some years ago, there was a country and western song that began with the line, take this job and shove it. And that is the sentiment that I hear everywhere these days. And I think, and this is so important, that it goes beyond the specifics of this job or that workplace. It is a cry from the working class of the United States that the system they are now finding themselves trapped in is no longer tolerable.
Now, if some of these workers who have been publicly quitting were in unions, and some of the things that I'm thinking about are Walmart workers who are not unionized, but if they'd been in unions, they might have chosen to stay and negotiate a better contract with their fellow workers. Only something like 10 or 12% of, or 15% maybe, of the American workforce is unionized. And we're seeing, in spite of that small level of unionization, a huge number of workers going on strike, right? And this doesn't even include those who might have threatened to go on strike and thereby won better contracts. But there have been a number of workers going on strike or threatening to go on strike, the Nabisco workers, the Kellogg workers, and others. And just imagine if we had a bigger percentage of unionized workers, we'd probably be seeing more strikes rather than resignations.
Absolutely. I think what you're going to discover is two or three things. Number one, the leadership taken by those workers at Nabisco that you mentioned and the workers at Kellogg that you mentioned has already had the effect of leading 10,000 workers at the John Deere Tractor Company to go out on strike. It's plunging the IATSE workers in Hollywood who make film and TV shows to think seriously about it, and so forth and so on. The more people strike, the more others begin to see that as an option, as an alternative, as something that the employer now has to worry about in a way that employers didn't before. And the other thing I would add is that the discovery of the people quitting is a painful discovery, but they're having it already. Yes, you quit because it was intolerable. And you went to these other places. But when you went to these other places, in some of which you took the job there, that the conditions aren't that different, that the other places you hope to go through are suffering the same kinds of pressures and squeezes that led you to leave the other job in the first place. So that, yes, I think there's a learning process going on here in which the revitalization of unions, the reformation of unions, and the putting of unions on a more militant path is the only way at this point for millions of workers to get the kinds of basic conditions that they are demanding, and rightly so.
Richard, it's, you know, there's this terrible propaganda against unions, right? Even if unions are generally seen as positive, workers often fear, for example, having to weather a strike without income. There's this fear that if the majority votes, you'll have to go along with it. But what isn't getting as much coverage is that there have actually been some successful negotiations here in Southern California, where I'm based. Thousands of workers at the drugstores CVS and Rite Aid just won a major new contract. They won a 10% pay raise plus new safety standards. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. That didn't make it in the headlines because the workers didn't have to resort to going on strike, but they could have. And your collective bargaining power yielded results that, you know, are pretty tangible, right?
Yes, you know, the argument against unions that you point to, and you're quite right about it, have always been there. In other words, workers have long understood, without it being thrown in their faces, that when you go on strike, you are always taking a chance, because during the period of your strike, your employer does not pay you, and that you never recover that money if you out for a few weeks and then you go back, for example. That's a few weeks lost. And remember, every week is 2% of your annual salary. So if you're out a month, that's almost 10% of your annual income. This is a terrible blow for you to suffer. And so workers don't do that lightly. They take that into account, you can be very sure. And what that means is when workers then do strike, as they are doing in record numbers, it's because of a deeper, more fundamental feeling that they are not respected on the job, that their concerns count for nothing, and that they are not willing to accept that position in society. So that even if it costs them a few weeks of lost pay, this is so fundamentally important that they are willing to undertake that risk and expense, because they have a world to win and not much anymore to lose. If I were a member of the employer class, which I am not, but if I were, I would be very concerned that you are arriving at a tipping point when the ability to dictate to the mass of the people, the majority, the ability of the minority of employers to dictate to the majority is now being challenged. And this is a very basic point in the history of every capitalism.
Richard, it's remarkable to see mainstream economists grapple with the Great Resignation, as they're calling it. The Wall Street Journal had a number of writers collaborating on an article. 4.3 million workers are missing. Where did they go? And you see a lot of articles like this. And, you know, employers are scratching their heads. But of course, you know, if they simply tried to retain workers by massively investing in those workers, simply by paying them really well, helping their schedules be more predictable, which is a common complaint about unpredictable schedules, giving them really great health benefits, that's a pretty straightforward way to retain workers, right? But they're scratching their heads wondering, what can we do to keep workers from resigning?
Well, you know, your question forces me to admit that I am embarrassed very often by my professional colleagues in economics when they stop being economic analysts and become what really needs to be called economic apologists, that they apologize for the system. Of course, there's no mystery. In the first semester of every economics curriculum, you learn about supply and demand. And you learn, among other things, that if you want a greater supply of something to be produced, you can offer a higher price for it, and that's how you get it done. If there's a shortage in any meaningful sense of workers, because they are quitting jobs, because they are upset with the conditions, well, then the answer is offer them more money, offer them better conditions, provide for them what you need to provide so there isn't a shortage. Let me remind everyone that in other countries that are capitalists like we are, there is nonetheless very little of this conversation. Why might that be? Well, let me give you an example of, say, France or Germany or Spain or Italy. In those countries, for example, the law requires everybody to have who has a job, no matter how much education he or she did or didn't get, you, the employer, must provide that person with 4 to 5 weeks of paid vacation every year, period. That's the law. Well, workers would be less exhausted, less tired, less bitter, less played out. If you did that in the United States, where nothing remotely like that exists as the law, neither in the country as a whole, nor in any of the 50 states. Let me give you another example. Paid maternity leave for mothers, paid paternity leave for fathers.
And a lot of this, by the way, is in the Build Back Better bill that Democrats are trying to pass.
Right, the irony is that President Biden proposes to do a modest version of what has already been the case in Europe for decades, and he can't even get that passed in this country. That's the pressure of the employer class. They're the ones who line the pockets of the GOP to block Mr. Biden from doing that. And a few, of course, compliant Democrats go along with that. But it is exactly one of the many conditions that are making workers quit or strike. And again, I warn the employer class, you are provoking the mass of people to turn against not just this or that employer by quitting, and not even this or that employer by striking, but you're beginning to teach the working class in a very concrete, real way that the problem here is the system that produces the absence of the laws that exist in Europe, the absence of the conditions that would make returning to work something other than the horror show workers are now showing they feel it to be.
Richard, a lot of the pushback is from employers saying, sure, they could, if they increased salaries, that might retain workers, but inflation, right? Because then they would have to pass on those increased costs to the consumer, which would raise prices. And you said earlier that we are seeing increased inflation. However, aren't the, especially the big corporations, just sitting on masses of revenues that they end up using to, you know, do stock buybacks and give their CEOs huge compensation packages and bonuses. They do have the money that they don't have to necessarily pass on wage raises to the consumer. They just want to keep more of it, right?
Absolutely. I hate always to be in this position of reteaching basic economics to people who, of course, know what the truth of the matter is. But let me remind you, in a capitalist system, there's a specific group of people who have the power to raise prices of food, clothing, shelter, equipment, everything else. Those people are called employers. They set the prices. The employees don't do that. That's not a function of any employee. That's always the function of the employer. Employers are a small minority of our population. Employees are the vast majority. So if you're concerned about an inflation, your proper object of concern is the employer class, because they're the ones who decide to raise the price of a box of cereal or a pair of shoes or a hamburger or anything else. Number one. Number two, if they raise the price to make more profits, which is what most of them are doing, and that's their job to do, that's what they were trained in Master of Business Administration curriculum to do, they have a problem. Because if you raise your prices to make more profits, you might, guess, make your customers angry. Because you would be confronting the customers with a simple truth. I am going to diminish your standard of living by raising the price of your breakfast cereal in order to make more profits for me and my shareholders. In other words, advantage me, screw you. Well, they're not going to do that because they aren't stupid. So they have to come up with another reason. I'm not raising the prices to make more profits. Oh, no. I'm only doing it because I have no choice. And you know why I have no choice? Because the prices I pay for my inputs and the prices I pay in wages to my workers have gone up, and I'm purely passing it on. Don't blame me. Well, the only way to verify that that's true would be to see the books of the company, which is precisely what they do not have to show us, and they never do.
Well, Richard, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And I certainly hope that your book with the new introduction is widely read. We'll post a link to that from our website. Thanks so much, Richard.
Thank you, Sonali, and thank you for the programs you keep producing.
My guest has been Richard Wolff, Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and we've been talking about his book Understanding Marxism, which has just been republished with a new introduction. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Federal prosecutions of January 6th rioters continue as participants in the deadly action at the Capitol face prosecutions and convictions. A House panel investigating the attack is also reportedly readying a charge of criminal contempt against Donald Trump's former advisor, Steve Bannon, over his refusal to comply with a subpoena over the probe. But strong as the response to the January 6th riot sounds, there has been little attention paid to a non-participant on the other side of the political spectrum who has received a harsher sentence than most rioters for doing little other than exercising his First Amendment rights. Daniel Baker, a self-described anarchist based in Florida, has been sentenced to 44 months in federal prison for calling for armed self-defense against gun-toting white supremacists. My guest is Natasha Leonard, columnist for The Intercept. Her work has appeared in The Nation, Book Forum, and The New York Times, among others. She teaches critical journalism at the New School for Social Research in New York, and she's the author of Being Numerous, Essays on Non-Fascist Life. She joins me now to discuss her latest article in The Intercept entitled, A Florida Anarchist Will Spend Years in Prison for Online Posts Prompted by the January 6th Riot. Welcome to the program, Natasha.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So first, let's talk about the fact that this person seemingly did absolutely nothing other than speak. He didn't go to Washington, D.C. on January 6th. So who is Daniel Baker and what is he actually accused of doing?
Right. So Daniel Baker is a Florida-based anarchist, as you say, also a yoga teacher, a practicing Hare Krishna, and is very involved in local community mutual aid down in Tallahassee. He was arrested just over a week after the January 6th riots. There was an FBI raid on his home because following January the 6th, he had taken to social media, particularly Facebook, and put out these, you know, really quite bellicose, I will say, and somewhat reckless given the political climate, calls to arms. But they were very, very general, not aimed at specific individuals, not, you know, planning any sort of specific January 6th counter events with any sort of timing, any sort of meetup points. But the idea was, as many people feared, including the FBI itself, that far-right groups, mobs, and militiae around the country would storm local state houses around Joe Biden's inauguration in sort of a swarm of follow-up copycat mini January the 6th. So Baker, who is on the left, and very much has committed much of his life to countering far-right white supremacist ideologies and organizing, put out this call to say, no, you know, we should defend against these white supremacist mobs should they amass again. You know, we did not in fact see huge follow-ups to January 6th, in large part because there was a lot of, you know, formal law enforcement backup brought into local state houses. But certainly Baker's concern about more January 6th to come were not in and of themselves rare. In fact, they were common. But he was charged and then convicted of sending interstate threats by virtue of making these kind of very vague, although quite aggressive, online statements. I don't think there's a reasonable way that these statements, however reckless they were, could be read as genuine threats worthy of 44 months in prison. Consider the fact, as I mentioned in my article, that a man from Georgia who had driven across state lines with guns and ammo in tow to attend January 6th had missed the riot because of car trouble, but was sending texts saying, I'm going to shoot Nancy Pelosi in the head, and had in fact traveled across state lines with guns, received a considerably shorter sentence for the same charge, interstate threats. You know, Baker did not in fact name anyone as a target, never attended any sort of event, did not go towards the Tallahassee State House with a gun, did not in fact gather individuals together in some sort of anti-fascist group. So just as a point of law, these this unequal false equivalence and in fact further persecution of the left-wing anti-fascist protester who did not in fact even attend a protest is notable. And you know, that's not even to speak of the fact that our judicial system would of course not consider that there should be no moral equivalence drawn between fascist organizing and the anti-fascists who might want to organize against them, for example, Baker.
Right. I mean, it's quite remarkable that we see, especially during the Trump years, so many white supremacists so openly calling for things like armed self-defense, really skirting the line around incitement of violence, even before the January 6th riot, you know, something that might have been far worse than what Daniel Baker called for, would have been shrugged off and accepted as, well, it's their Second Amendment right, right?
Yeah, I mean, it should have been a pretty straightforward First Amendment protected case. And as you say, yes, it's hardly rare that on from the far right, we see constant overtures online to armed overturning of the Biden result, to armed revolution, you know, in defense of white standing. It's very, very common, you know, and Baker's, I actually, you know, I personally don't have a problem with physically confronting fascists. And I've written at length about why that's often, in fact, a kind of well-informed and philosophically well-informed approach to fascist mobs and fascist organizing, actual physical confrontation. But more to the point in terms of Baker's case, whether I think there are moral justifications for physically confronting fascists or not, it shouldn't even matter, because no such confrontations took place. All Baker was doing was, as you say, engaging in what should be protected speech. This was by no reasonable standard could be understood as a direct threat. No given person was threatened.
So this is a man who was held for, you point out, 10 grueling months during his trial, 7 of which were in solitary confinement. And now he's sentenced to 44 months in prison. It seems as though he has been, you know, he's being made a scapegoat of. Did you get a chance to communicate with him in writing about his story? I mean, I really haven't seen the story anywhere else.
Yes, so I was one of his friends in who was part of his support committee, actually reached out to me to let me know about the story. So then I looked into it, and some articles were written at the time of his arrest, at the time of the FBI raid. And there was a good piece in Jacobin, actually, that pointed out that his prosecution is, or you know, already evidence come to fruition that we don't want the kind of rubric of counter-terror to be totally embraced by the government as if that's the way we're going to kill white supremacy in this country, by embracing a state apparatus counter-terror program that, of course, inevitably will, cause further harm for the left and for Black liberation struggle and other kind of social justice movements that aren't white supremacists, such as the history of state counter-terror. So that was noted at the time of his arrest, but then really nothing was said about him aside from in hyper-local press. And then when his sentencing was coming up, and then we discovered how much longer it would be than a lot of the what one could call charge-wise comparable January 6th cases, it seemed worth drawing attention to. So I had been in touch with his support committee and his attorneys, and then also spoke to him a number of times on the phone. He was allowed 50-minute calls from federal prison and via the kind of prison email system calling. So we did, we were in pretty regular contact while I was reporting the story. And he told me some pretty harrowing things that are also part of a lawsuit he has filed against the Bureau of Prisons for his treatment. For example, when he was held in solitary in the special housing unit SHU, he was cycled around cells that would consistently be covered in feces because an incarcerated person next to him, a gentleman, had been held for 2 years, considered mentally unfit for trial, had clear severe mental illness. Baker later found out by contacting the man's family that he was autistic and that the prison was not making accommodations for that in any way. So this very, very disturbed man was, covering his cell with feces and throwing his feces. And this was where Baker was placed during months of solitary confinement, again, for writing emails. And to be clear, I believe in prison abolition per se. It's not that I think, only the January 6th people should go to prison and otherwise, prisons are great aside from when it's for leftists. Like, obviously, incarceration is the problem here, but it is particularly striking given what Baker was charged for and convicted of.
Do you know if there's any efforts around a support group or a campaign for Baker or appealing his sentencing or anything that, people who are listening to this, watching this interview might be feeling outraged and want to rally in support of him?
So he will be appealing his conviction, and that will be, happening. That he will be starting to seek appeal immediately. There's not a specific fund, but if you look for Daniel Baker Tallahassee on Twitter, you will see that there are various links to his book wish list he wants to be reading while he's incarcerated, and you can send books to him via that wish list. You can do it in a way that accords with prison regulations around books received and whatnot. But yeah, there's not a specific fund right now, but I'm sure if you keep an eye on Daniel Baker Tallahassee, if you're on Twitter, and I will be keeping people abreast of what happens in the case and the appeal going forward.
Again, thank you so much, Natasha. We'll post a link to your article from our website, risingupatsonali.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
My guest has been Natasha Leonard. She is a columnist for The Intercept, author of Being, numerous essays on non-fascist life. That article I referred to is entitled, A Florida Anarchist Will Spend Years in Prison for Online Posts Prompted by the January 6th Riot. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
This is your community-supported radio station, KBOO Portland. Before we get going with our programming, I want to remind everyone that you can donate today at kbu.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online. Again, that's kbu.fm/give. Or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Thank you.
Tune in on fourth Thursdays at 3 a.m. for The Metal Margin with me, your host, The Metal Maestra, featuring all women and people of color in metal, including this band from Navajo Nation, female-fronted Existence AD.